It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is all the way up to 26 degrees. Out at the airport, they are showing westerly winds at 3 miles per hour, and they have 10 miles of visibility, air travelers. The Weather Service is calling for sunny skies for the rest of the day, high near 30, northwest winds to 15. Clear skies tonight with an overnight low of 18, northwest winds to 30. And for tomorrow, a 20% chance of snow afternoon, but otherwise sunny skies, high near 26, north winds to 20, gusting to 30. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Shunack Tribe of Kodiak and the Aleutic Museum have teamed up to release a textbook to help revitalize the endangered Aleutic language. Anchorage Economic Development Corporation is advocating the creation of the first ever Anchorage sales tax in the city. And the war in Ukraine has meant no Russian input to the Arctic modeling that the two countries do.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Election year politics surrounding immigration could upend months of talks over a foreign aid and border security package, just as congressional negotiators are close to finalizing the text on a bipartisan deal. Punchbowl News first reported that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell cited the need to not undermine former President Donald Trump, who wants to build his campaign for the GOP presidential nomination around immigration. A spokesperson for McConnell did not dispute the report when NPR asked for comment. NPR's Eric McDaniel has more on what's at stake for new migrant arrivals, U.S. border communities, and the politics of an issue in a year where Americans may once again see a Biden-Trump rematch.
Negotiators agree that the status quo at the U.S. southern border is not sustainable. As many as 10,000 people present themselves to border protection agents each day, overwhelming available resources. But in a presidential campaign year facing opposition from GOP frontrunner Donald Trump, there are real questions about whether a deal can get done. Democratic negotiator Chris Murphy indicated the ball is now in Republicans' court.
We have produced a compromise that they asked for with the chosen negotiator that they appointed, and it is now up to them as to whether they want to accept the agreement.
Draft text of the deal is expected as early as next week. Eric McDaniel, NPR News, The Capitol.
Today, Trump testified briefly in his own defense in the defamation case brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. Here's NPR's Andrea Bernstein.
Out of the presence of the jury, Judge Lewis Kaplan sternly instructed the defense Trump could not deny that he had sexually assaulted Carroll in a department store dressing room in the 1990s because a previous jury already found that he had. He did it, and that's the law, Kaplan said. Have you personally made him aware of the restrictions on his testimony? He asked Trump's attorney, Alina Haba. While she was trying to answer, Trump could be heard to say from the defense table, I have not met the woman. I don't know who the woman is. But on the witness stand, he said only that he stood by a taped deposition he gave to Carroll's lawyers and that he denied her allegations from the White House because, quote, I just wanted to defend myself. After a brief question from Carroll's lawyers, it was over in minutes. Trump left the courtroom repeating, this is not America. Andrea Bernstein, NPR News, New York.
The U.S. is planning talks with Iraq on how to bring an end to the longstanding American-led military coalition in Iraq. NPR's Greg Myrie reports the goal is a new security arrangement between the two countries.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says in a statement that talks will begin within days to work out what he calls a, quote, enduring bilateral security partnership. The U.S. still has about 2,500 troops in Iraq. They're part of an international coalition sent there a decade ago to fight the Islamic State. The coalition defeated the Islamic State, but American forces have remained as part of an effort to stabilize Iraq.
NPR's Greg Myrie reporting. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. The Shunack Tribe of Kodiak, in collaboration with the Aleutic Museum, have released a textbook to help revitalize an endangered Alaska Native language. As KMXT's Davis Hovey reports, it's a new tool to teach the next generation of Aleutic speakers.
The Aleutic language, also known as Sukpiak, is broken up into two main dialects, the Koniag Aleutic, spoken in Kodiak, as well as the Upper Alaska Peninsula, and the Chugach Aleutic, which is spoken on the Kenai Peninsula. A new Aleutic language textbook, released last month, focuses on the Koniag dialect, although it's open to anyone who wants to learn Aleutic. Derek Chaya works at the Aleutic Museum and is one of the co-authors. He says many Aleutic speakers were consulted to create this textbook.
Whenever we're doing any language, like producing any language materials, we work as much as we can with language speakers who live here in Kodiak. Over the past few years, that's gotten harder and harder as speakers have passed on.
Of the roughly two dozen elders who are fluent in the Kodiak Island dialect, the museum worked with four of them to make sure pronunciations, grammar, and other aspects of the textbook were accurate, although not all of them are still alive today to see it published. Chaya started his language journey with nearly no knowledge of Aleutic, having rarely heard it spoken when he was growing up. Now he is an advanced speaker who still considers himself a language learner. He says this textbook, in conjunction with all the other online language resources, can help revitalize the endangered Alaska Native language. But there are still challenges that exist for a beginner to become fluent in Aleutic.
I think the hardest part of learning the language is like finding time to like use it with somebody, because language learning for a lot of people is quite a personal journey, and not everybody has the opportunity to have other people around them who are also learning at the same time or at the same rate.
With elders and fluent Aleutic speakers dying off, there is a need for more speaker teachers to help the next generation achieve proficiency in their second language. That's where Peggy Azuyak comes in. She's teaching Aleutic language classes to young adults at the Kodiak College under the University of Alaska Anchorage.
I'm using it right now in our Aleutic 102 class. This is the first semester I'm able to use it with students.
Azuyak says the new textbook is easier to follow compared to the previous one they used from the 1970s. The new Aleutic language textbook features 15 chapters, including sections on numbers and math, and is targeted towards high school and college age students.
Many of the students also, through their tribal or corporation organizations, do teach the language. Several high school students have been interested in going through either the Kodiak High School or the Kodiak College courses and are involved with teaching the language in their home communities.
The Shunack tribe has plans to distribute hard copies to all of the schools in the communities on Kodiak Island after they are printed. Anyone who wants to learn to speak Aleutic can access the Aleutic language textbook online for free at aleuticlanguage.org. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
The leadership of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation is advocating for the creation of a new 3% city sales tax, with two-thirds dedicated to property tax relief and one-third for public projects. Ryan Strong, head of the AEDC's board, announced the push during the nonprofit's annual forecast luncheon Wednesday.
Specifically for revenue diversification, property tax relief that increases housing affordability, and community investment projects that increase our quality of life in Anchorage.
Strong, who is also an executive with the First National Bank of Alaska, spoke while about 1,500 attendees ate lunch. He said a sales tax could spur big changes in Anchorage, and that the concept is modeled after Oklahoma City's MAPS initiative, a 1% sales tax created in 1993 specifically for public projects. Strong said voters there renew it every time it's on the ballot.
That funded projects like a 70-acre park downtown, an NBA basketball arena, a sidewalk program to connect neighborhoods and amenities across the city, multiple senior health and wellness centers, and more. Beyond simply making the city a more enjoyable place to live, MAPS kickstarted 30 years of population increases and economic growth that continues to this day.
In an interview, AEDC Executive Director Jenna Wright fleshed out the sales tax concept, which she said business leaders and partner organizations coalesced around in meetings this past summer.
A 3% sales tax with two-thirds of it going to property tax relief would result in about a 20% reduction in property taxes for both residential and commercial property owners. And then we would mirror that 1% that Oklahoma City found so successful for the community investment projects.
Wright said AEDC is just beginning to shop the idea around more widely. There's a lot more work to be done, she said.
We're going to talk about it with more groups and see, you know, if there is an appetite for it in Anchorage and if it's what Anchorage residents want. But we truly believe that we should be investing in ourselves here in Anchorage.
The sales tax push came out of work on AEDC's Choose Anchorage campaign, which was unveiled last year. One consequence of the war in Ukraine is the loss of Russian input to an international Arctic monitoring and modeling project. KUAC's Dan Bross explains.
University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Arctic Biology Professor Sindonia Brethart is part of a European Union-funded project called INTERACT, which gathers data from scientists at field stations around the Arctic for the development of terrestrial climate change response models. But Russia's invasion of Ukraine resulted in the EU pulling funding for Russian researchers, and Vladimir Putin made it illegal for them to transmit data out of the country. Brethart is one of the authors of a recently published EU-funded analysis of the impacts of the loss of input from Russia's 21 field stations on the INTERACT project.
Perhaps not surprisingly, what the paper shows is that the Russian stations are actually really important in terms of getting a handle on what the variability is across the whole Arctic.
Brethart says Russia represents about half of the Arctic landmass, so the loss of on-the-ground measurements has significant impacts on the development and performance of the Earth system's models.
You're not going to be able to refine your models as well in the future or to get data that predicts exactly what's going on.
She notes that the INTERACT project still has access to satellite-gathered data from Russia, which is useful.
But in terms of understanding the ecological processes, there's really no substitute for measurements that are made, you know, on the ground at different sites to understand why changes are happening and to fully capture what those changes are.
Brethart says the EU INTERACT project successfully brought Russian scientists into contact with their counterparts in the West, and the longer the war prevents that connection, the harder it will be to rebuild. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
For the dozens of Alaska Native communities weighing relocation because of climate change, the path forward isn't clear. A report out this week from the Alaska Tribal Health Consortium calls on Congress to streamline federal response to climate change and close an enormous funding gap in order to do so. KYUK's Emily Schwing reports.
The federal government's system for providing resources and services to address climate change and environmental threats remains inequitable and inefficient. That's according to a new report that evaluates the unmet needs of nearly 150 Alaska Native villages that are dealing with the impacts of climate change. Jackie Schaefer is the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Director of Climate Initiatives. She says the federal government isn't structured in a way that's meeting the needs of those communities.
We're already dealing with inequitable placement of infrastructure. So most of these high-risk communities don't have basic infrastructure such as water and sewer. But, I mean, how do you engineer for that when you couple it with climate change and melting permafrost and potential managed retreat or relocation? So to me, it's a compounding issue.
The consortium's new report identifies an enormous funding gap, $80 million annually over the next 10 years.
You could look at it through that lens of preventative or responsive, right? And so I think that does sound like a lot of money, but if we do nothing, what is that dollar amount?
The report also includes those numbers. It says if the federal government doesn't act, it could spend an estimated $25.8 billion in emergency response and recovery costs. Permafrost degradation, land subsidence, erosion. The list of severe impacts that result from a changing climate is not breaking news in Alaska. In fact, since 2004, the federal government has released more than a half dozen reports that highlight the same kinds of funding gaps, lack of agency cooperation, and overall lack of progress to help Alaska's indigenous communities shore up threatened critical infrastructure qualify for federal assistance, and in some cases fully relocate. Don Antrobus is the Climate Change Adaptation Program Manager at the consortium.
If we're done right here, if we publish the report and that's it, then, you know, it will be just another report that goes on the shelf. So I think, you know, there's a lot of strategizing to be done about what comes next. We're going to have to come up with a pretty robust plan for telling our story so that, you know, it's the one that's on the top of the stack.
That story Antrobus points to is playing out in real time right now all over rural Alaska. And perhaps it's most dramatic in Nutok, where decades of permafrost degradation and erosion mean the entire community of nearly 400 people has to move 9 miles across a river. 22-year-old Jimmy Kasiley was born and raised in Nutok.
I've got to say goodbye to home sweet home. Yeah, say hello to the new home. New life, new beginning.
Is it sad to leave?
It is, but just gotta take it positive.
3 generations of his family live in a small old house at the north end of the village. That includes his older brother, Christopher, and Christopher's twin toddlers.
And they'll be telling us it's not safe here because of the erosion and the floods. It's not going to be the same.
Is it scary for you?
I'm scared for my twins because they're just babies.
The new report has a few major recommendations. Congress, it says, should create a single funding source and streamline the way federal agencies respond to climate change. It also says Congress needs to address tribal inequities. Jackie Schaefer says the report is not limited to the Alaskan experience. It also has national significance.
This report is not only to help our tribes understand that all these stories are valid, this is your living history, but for federal agency partners to understand that these are barriers that have been in place that create inequities in response to climate change.
Schaefer says there's a sense of urgency because the cost of hard infrastructure is going up and the acceleration of climate change is speeding up. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
In a related story, the Federal Emergency Management Agency will overhaul its disaster assistance program in response to an uptick in extreme weather events brought on by a changing climate and feedback from disaster survivors. As KYUK's Emily Schwing reports, thousands of Alaskans have applied for individual disaster assistance in just the last 2 years.
FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell says a series of changes that go into effect at the end of March are some of the most sweeping for the agency in the past 2 decades. Criswell says she's aware of Alaska's unique needs.
This will help enable them to utilize their resources better within their own communities to help them on their recovery journey.
In September 2022, the most dramatic storm in living memory hammered Alaska's west coast. In the year after Typhoon Murbach, many survivors struggled to appeal applications that they made to replace subsistence hunting and fishing gear. FEMA says temporary housing assistance applications will be more streamlined in the future. The agency will also create a new displacement assistance program. The changes go into effect this spring. They apply only to natural disasters that occur on or after March 22nd of this year. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
Microplastics are everywhere. The tiny fragments from things like clothing fibers, fishing line, textiles, and other harder plastics can accumulate and build up in waterways.
They can be mistaken for food by small organisms, so zooplankton, fish, even birds, and then they can make their way up the food chain.
Deani Chapman is a state director of the Alaska Environmental Research and Policy Center. She recently co-authored a study that examined microplastic content in various water sources across South Central Alaska, from rivers and lakes to tap water in 3 different Anchorage neighborhoods.
They all had microplastics. 100% of our samples, we took 39 altogether, had microplastics in them, which was pretty disappointing.
She says microplastics have led to fertility and mobility issues in animals. They also can attract and accumulate additional pollutants like DDT, pesticides, and heavy metals. Chapman says she was surprised to find out that the highest levels of microplastics in South Central waters were in more rural areas as opposed to urban waters near Anchorage. She says that's an indication that a lot of the microplastic pollution is coming in from other places.
That indicates that probably a fair bit of that microplastic pollution is coming in through rain and snow from other parts around the globe. However, we know that there are local sources for plastic pollution as well.
Chapman says it won't be easy to get microplastics out of the water, but the study has several big-picture recommendations, including phasing out single-use plastics, using natural fibers for clothing production, and even using plastic-free materials to make fishing line. Meanwhile, Chapman says using a standard water filter should eliminate any microplastics coming from a tap. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has a new regional director for the state of Alaska. The federal agency, which oversees offshore waters around the whole country, has new renewable energy goals. KDLL's Riley Board talked with the director about that effort.
I'm Givi Kohodovsky. I'm the regional director for the Alaska region of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. So our agency is responsible for the federal waters offshore development of the Outer Continental Shelf. And historically, we've been down here in this region on oil and gas matters, but our portfolio is much broader than that. We also have obligations in renewable energy, carbon storage, and critical minerals. And our activities on the Kenai this week are focused on initial steps to build stakeholder engagement and hear from the people and listen from the people of this region on potential renewable energy development for Cook Inlet.
What other meetings do you have planned for your time on the peninsula?
So we have a wide range of meetings lined up. We're taking advantage of meeting with the media wherever possible. We have tribal meetings set. We're meeting with Cook Inlet Keepers, the mayor's office. We just met with CAPED. So this is the first of several trips we're going to be making this year. I think it's unrealistic to have meaningful relationships if there's no sustainment with them. So our goal is to be down here on a monthly basis through the Cook Inlet Work Group and other members of our staff to plug into existing community functions, talking with fishermen, talking with industry folks, talking with various community stakeholders that have interest and equities in the future of Cook Inlet and what offshore development means to them and what it looks like. Because ultimately we need to be doing proper studies to make sure that the impacts of this work are both environmentally and economically friendly to the U.S. government, and also that we're not leaving communities in the lurch, that we really need to start communication early and often. And that's why we're quite a few years away from final action of any sort. There is no determined action right now that we're going to take. But right now we're building the groundwork by talking to stakeholders and getting a sense of what their concerns and issues are so that they can be addressed and mitigated through environmental impact studies or through other actions that we will take in the leasing and plans process, the environmental reviews, or evaluation of the economics of the projects.
And what's something that you would want folks living on the Central Peninsula to know about your organization and the work that you're hoping to do here?
I would say the first thing is for people to look into us a little bit. We're not a very well-known federal agency. In our current form, we've existed about 10 years. There was a predecessor organization called the Mineral Management Service that predated BOEM. But if you go to BOEM.gov, you can read about our mission and what we're doing. There's a separate page about Alaska. But I think education is the key first step, just so people know what our responsibilities are, that this is not a bunch of nameless, faceless bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. dictating to Alaska what's going to happen. It's really a bunch of Alaskans. There's 43 of us in the regional office in Anchorage. And we are relying on the knowledge and the experience of the local folks here in the region that would be most directly impacted by any sort of development to be the voice and the data points for us to better understand what's going on so that we can make informed decisions. And we are not unique in the federal family of agencies, but we're one of the agencies that has a standalone Alaska region, which means the vast majority of the decision-making is made in Alaska, and there's local control by our team on that. and the process is handled entirely in the state of Alaska. So this is, I think, a very workable model. It's worked well in our past activities that we've done in the oil and gas realm, and now we're just translating that to the renewable field.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. Is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you'd want to mention?
I think one thing that's kind of interesting to think about is people know how big Alaska is. It's about 586,000 square miles. But when you look at the offshore jurisdiction of the federal government around Alaska, it's three times the size of the state. So it's massive. It's over 1 billion acres of territory. And within that, we are looking to do our due diligence and federal responsibility of economically and environmentally sound management of that territory for the best interests of our country and the shareholders and the stakeholders that we support, the taxpayers. I think the other thing that's really important here is our team really seeks to earn the trust and respect of the communities that we serve. So through highly credible science, good work in our processes that we use to regulate and permit is something that we're seeking to do as a team. We also seek to be relevant in the changing Arctic that our state faces here, and also the changing world in our agency, that it's not just legacy oil and gas. While that certainly is important to us and we'll continue to work in that space, we are looking at the new portfolios of renewables and critical minerals and carbon storage. And then most importantly, just so that we are ready for whatever the future brings. As you know, this is an election year. There's a lot of politics and energy. We could be going a very different direction a year from now. And it's our responsibility as the Alaska team to be ready for whatever that future holds so that we can best serve the taxpayers and the national interest.
The American economy surprises again. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute. In the last 3 months of last year, the economy grew at an annual rate of 3.3%. That's the Commerce Department's initial estimate of fourth quarter GDP growth. And it's better than economists expected, although it is, as expected, not as robust as the previous quarter when GDP growth was at a blistering 4.9%. The Federal Reserve has been cooling the economy down to bring inflation under control. The Biden administration is releasing $5 billion from the infrastructure law for improvements throughout the country. It will fund 37 projects. $1 billion will go to replace a critical bridge in Wisconsin, a state that's projected to be a key battleground in the upcoming election. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute.
Marketplace Minute is supported by KeyBank. Learn more at key.com/sustainability.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your Island Messenger for Thursday. It is the 25th day of January, the year 2024. The sun rose today at 9:26. It will set again at 5:18. That will give us 7 hours and 52 minutes of glorious daylight. A gain of 4 minutes and 2 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 50 degrees. That was set in 1950. And our record low was minus 3, set in 1947. Currently, a relatively warm 26 degrees. Fair skies. West winds at 3 miles per hour out at the airport, where they are also reporting 10 miles of visibility. Expect sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon, clear skies tonight, and sunny skies tomorrow too, although with a 20% chance of rain, no snow tomorrow afternoon. Northwest winds to 15 today, maybe up to 20 tonight, shifting to the north tomorrow to 20 and gusting to 30. Mostly clear overnight tomorrow night and sunny skies on Saturday. We have a high tide coming up. Our next high tide here on the east side will be at 1:29 this afternoon and be 9.6 feet. That'll be followed by a minus tide. Our low tide at 8:22 p.m. will be minus 8 tenths. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 2:01 p.m. and be 14.6 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 8:51 p.m. of minus 1.6 feet. Mariners, here is your weather forecast from Marmot Island to Sitkanak, out to 15 nautical miles. Gale warning for tomorrow. Northeast 15, except north 20, north of Dangerous Cape today, seas to 5 feet. For tonight, northeast 25, except north 25, north of Dangerous Cape, seas to 7 feet tonight. And for tomorrow, on our east side, north winds to 30 knots, except north 35, north of Dangerous Cape, seas to 7 feet, building to 8 feet, Friday night. For Saturday, look for northwest 30, seas to 8 feet, northwest 25 on Sunday with 7-foot seas. Mariners who may be offshore from 15 to 85 nautical miles off our east side in the Gulf of Alaska, you have a gale warning tomorrow, too. Northeast 15 out there right now, except north 20 north of Dangerous Cape, seas to 6 feet. Northeast 25 tonight with 7-foot seas. And for tomorrow, offshore, north 35, seas to 9 feet, building to 13 feet tomorrow night. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through tomorrow, and freezing spray in the Shelikof for today, tonight, and tomorrow. Northeast 25 today, seas to 5 feet. Northeast 30 tonight with 7-foot seas. Freezing spray today and tonight. And for tomorrow, northeast, north winds to 30 knots, seas to 7 feet with freezing spray. Going to be chilly over in the Shelikof. For inside waters, the Chiniak Bay, small craft advisory for tonight and Friday. Northwest winds to 15 knots today with seas to 2 feet, becoming north 25 tonight with 3-foot seas. And for tomorrow in Chiniak Bay, north 30, seas to 6 feet and freezing spray in Chiniak Bay tomorrow. Up in Marmot Bay, small craft advisory for tomorrow, north 20 today and seas to 2 feet, building to 4 feet tonight, and look for freezing spray tonight in Marmot Bay. For tomorrow, north 30, seas to 6 feet with freezing spray in Marmot Bay tomorrow, too. The following are upcoming meetings in the Kodiak Island Borough. On Thursday, January 25th, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. On Tuesday, January 30th, the Joint Building Code Review Committee will be having its regular meeting in the Borough Conference Room at 3 p.m. On Tuesday, January 30th, the Solid Waste Advisory Board will be having its regular meeting in the Kodiak Fisheries Research Center's conference room at 5:15 p.m. On Thursday, February 1st, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having its regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. All these meetings are open to the public. You can find meeting agendas and packets at the Kodiak Island Borough website. Call the Kodiak Island Borough Clerk with any questions at 907-486-9310. And things happening at the library include the postponed Traveler's Destination, featuring Roy and Crystal Thomas's journey to Tanzania and Mount Kilimanjaro. That was to have happened yesterday. That will be next Wednesday, January 31st at 6:30 p.m. It's open to everyone, and you can learn about their hikes and view their beautiful images of those vistas there. Again, that's next Wednesday at the library, 6:30 p.m. Tomorrow at the library at 10:30 a.m., they will host their regular Lap-Sit story time. That's for babies up to 3 years old. And join in the genre reading challenge that runs through February. Try reading from different genres and record your reading on a bingo card at kodiak.beanstack.org to earn prizes and learn something new. For more information, ask for help at the front desk of the library. For any information about the library, call them on the phone at 907-486-8686.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.